Moines Register for Friday, November 12th, 2021. I'm Dave Buzik, and my partner at the microphone for the next 90 minutes is Judith Linden. For this first hour, we'll read state and local news from the Des Moines Register, along with selections from USA Today. Birthdays and announcements come at the top of the hour, and then we'll continue with news for another 30 minutes before changing readers. Our second shift starts with the opinion pages. Obituaries will be read at 11 a.m. and 8 p.m., followed by sports. We'll wrap up our broadcast with Dear Abby and a weather recap. Support for today's reading comes from the Des Moines Register and donations from individuals and listeners like you. IRIS provides our 24/7 services and equipment to our listeners at no cost. If you'd like to learn more about how you can help us keep the volunteer voices of IRIS going strong, give us a call at 515-243-6833 or visit iowaradioreading.org. Now let's take a look at that lovely weather outside. Snow showers will continue through the afternoon with totals mainly below an inch, though far northern Iowa could see 1 to 2 inches of snow. And in fact, as I was coming in this morning, I heard that Interstate 35 was closed up near Williams by Highway 20 due to a bad crash, and that snowplows are out this morning in northern Iowa. Gusty winds exceeding 40 to 45 miles an hour out of the northwest, mainly in western Iowa, are expected today too, though windy across the entire state in general. You combine these winds with temperatures in the 30s, and you get a rather unpleasant weather day. Here now is the forecast for Des Moines and central Iowa specifically. Today it'll be windy, snow this morning tapering off by afternoon, but it will remain cloudy today. Temperatures near steady in the middle 30s. Winds from the west-northwest at 20 to 30 miles an hour in central Iowa. Chance of snow today, 80%. Winds could occasionally gust over 40 miles an hour. Not much accumulation here in the Des Moines area. Tonight, mainly cloudy, low 27. Winds continue out of the northwest at 15 to 25 miles an hour. Tomorrow, partly cloudy skies during the morning hours will become overcast in the afternoon, a high of 43. Winds calming, winds from the west-southwest at 5 to 10 miles an hour. Good chance to pick up all those leaves that have been blowing about for the past day or so. Tomorrow night, a few showers early with increasing winds and cloudy skies late, low 32 degrees, but winds from the west at 20 to 30 miles an hour and a 30% chance of rain on Saturday night. Sunday, then, considerable clouds early, some decreasing clouds later in the day, high 41, winds from the northwest at 15 to 25 miles an hour. Quick look at Monday, and then Tuesday sounds great. Monday, mostly cloudy, high 51, and then Tuesday, partly cloudy skies during the morning hours will become overcast in the afternoon, but a high around 65 degrees, winds from the south-southwest at 15 to 25 miles an hour with higher wind gusts possible. So, Judith, I have a feeling that summer is over.
Yes, thank you, Dave. Here are the headlines from the front page of today's Des Moines Register. Lawsuit faults jail in man's death. She was inspirational. Nohema Graber remembered as a leader in Fairfield's Latino community, and Chauvin jurors selected saw less of infamous video. And here is the first story. Lawsuit faults jail in man's death. His suicide at Polk County Jail was his third attempt. This story by William Morris. A man who took his own life at the Polk County Jail in 2019 was not on suicide watch, despite having returned from the hospital just days before, following a previous suicide attempt, his family says. Kimberly Vandermark sued Polk County, Sheriff Kevin Schneider, and various jail employees in October for allegedly failing to protect her son, Karanoix Rodriguez Jr., after his arrest in November 2019. According to the complaint, Rodriguez suffered fatal injuries in a November 24, 2019 suicide attempt and died in hospice care on December 13 without regaining consciousness. Jail staff had plenty of warning that Rodriguez, 27, might try to harm himself, Vandermark said. Rodriguez had been arrested several times that year on drug and theft charges and had twice attempted suicide and been hospitalized to treat his resulting injuries. His second attempt took place on November 21st, 3 days before his final attempt. Rodriguez also told Vandermark in a phone call from the jail that he was suicidal and she made numerous calls to jail officials to ask that he be placed on a suicide watch, according to the complaint. Vandermark said, however, there was no special monitoring in place when Rodriguez made his November 24 suicide attempt. Attorneys representing Vandermark did not return messages seeking comment. Lieutenant Ryan Evans, a spokesman for the sheriff's office, answered questions about the jail's policies, but declined to comment on specifics of Rodriguez's case, citing the pending litigation and confidential medical records. Polk County has several layers of policies intended to detect and prevent potential jail suicides, documents Evans provided show. Screening questionnaires during booking includes questions about mental health and suicidal thoughts. If there are any such concerns, either as a result of responses to the questionnaires or from staff observations, inmates can be placed in either dormitory units under constant supervision or in regular housing with staff check-ins every 30 minutes until a mental health assessment can be conducted. The jail also has safety cells designated for inmates at risk of self-harm. Inmates in safety cells are limited to clothing, bedding, and other items considered not to be a safety risk, and can face other restrictions, including safer diningware and being accompanied for showers. If a staff member detects emotional instability or a potential for suicidal behavior, inmates are to be moved to a safety cell and checked every 15 minutes until medical or mental health professionals can evaluate them, according to jail policy. Use of a safety cell is to be a last resort, and any placement there is to be reviewed at least once a day. All of these policies have been in place since 2011 and were in effect when Rodriguez died, but it is not clear whether they were followed. Evans declined to say what actions, if any, the jail took after Rodriguez's previous suicide attempts. According to the complaint, he was either not in a safety cell or had unsafe items with him in the safety cell when he made his third suicide attempt. It is also not clear if jail staff ordered a 30-minute observation log on Rodriguez, one of the options laid out in jail policy. Even if they didn't, the jail's watch tour policy calls for correction officers to make personal or eye-on contact with each inmate at a minimum of every 30 minutes. According to the complaint, a sheriff's office employee told the family that Rodriguez was not found until nearly an hour after the last check on him. It is possible that placing Rodriguez in a safety cell would have saved his life, but there are good reasons corrections institutions are reluctant to overuse such facilities, said Christine Totero, a Stockton University professor who studies jail suicides. Totero said back in the 70s and 80s, there was, I think, a different level of comfort with taking somebody, stripping them down, and just throwing them into an empty cell and calling that suicide prevention. As time has gone on, we have come to realize damage that can do to one's psyche and also how doing that does not really address the problem of why the person is suicidal in the first place, Totero said. The only certain way to prevent suicides, while also not inflicting further harm, is constant human interaction and supervision, Totero said. That can be from a staff member assigned to round-the-clock monitoring. Some facilities also are turning to trained inmate buddies who accompany an at-risk fellow prisoner and ensure they are not left alone. Totero said, we are trying to move away from put the person in isolation and walk away. In cases where a person is an immediate threat to themselves or others, it's still sometimes necessary to isolate them. And Totero said it is important for a medical staff to clear them before they are returned to the general jail population. Schneider, according to the complaint, told the family a third-party psychiatrist had examined their son and said he was fine and did not need to be on suicide watch. The family does not know who that psychiatrist was. Medical and mental health services at the jail are provided by WellPath, a third-party contractor. In general, a prisoner who had just attempted suicide days before would seem to be at high risk to try again, Totero said. If the jail was relying on medical recommendations in keeping Rodriguez off suicide watch, though, it could be a major barrier to Vandermark's lawsuit. I don't think the courts would find the corrections agency erred in that situation if they were listening to a licensed professional, she said. Vandermark says she was not notified of her son's first suicide attempt at the jail, which happened in April 2019. After his third attempt, as he lay dying in hospice, Vandermark and her husband met with Schneider and other officials at the jail. Schneider apologized to Vandermark and told her they were in the process of making some policy changes so this will not happen again, according to the complaint. Evans declined to comment on any policy changes made in the wake of Rodriguez's death. According to Evans, there have been 226 suicide attempts at the jail since 2010, including 39 since November 2019. Eight attempts resulted in an in-custody death. It was not immediately clear if those figures included Rodriguez, who was released to a hospital and then hospice care before he died. Other jails have also struggled to prevent suicides. A 2016 Des Moines Register investigation found at least 19 Iowa jail inmates had died by suicide since 2013. John Goddard, then president of the Iowa State Sheriffs and Deputies Association, attributed the problem in part to a shortage of mental health treatment options in local communities. Goddard said at the time, "The jails are doing the best they can, but this is a mental health crisis, and we've got the state shutting down mental health facilities. Where do those people go? Jail. And the jails are being tasked to do more than they were ever designed to do," Goddard said. In custody, suicides have grown in frequency since 2016. A study released in April by the U.S. Department of Justice found in 2018, the most recent year for which data was available, nationwide in-custody deaths by suicide had risen 20% over 2017 figures to their highest level since reporting began in 2000. Vandermark's lawsuit, filed October 14, accuses the county and its officers of negligence, gross negligence, and reckless disregard for Rodriguez's safety. It seeks damages, including punitive damages, for his parents and his three minor children. The county has not yet filed an answer in court.
And a second front page story today on Friday, November 12th. She was inspirational. Noema Graber, remembered as a leader in Fairfield's Latino community. And this story is accompanied by a photograph of a chain link fence, presumably outside the school that's become a gathering place for remembrances, a bit of a shrine. there's a large poster board with pictures of Noema Graber. There are flowers hanging on the fence and candles along the bottom. The story by Andrea May Sahuri. Just before her violent death, Noema Graber shared her life's philosophy and tradition. She told a Fairfield Ledger reporter on November 1st, "We know we're all going to die. It's our way of laughing at death." She was at the Fairfield Public Library for a celebration of Dia de los Muertos, or Day of the Dead, as she laughed at death. Then, the next day, on November 2nd, the second day of Dia de los Muertos, Graber was killed. Her body was found in a park that she loved. On November 4th, two 16-year-old Fairfield High School students were charged with her murder. Graber, a Mexican immigrant and Fairfield High School's Spanish teacher, was proud of her Mexican roots and worked to share her culture and build a stronger Latino community. Her death has devastated the Fairfield community and Graber's family. Graber's daughter described her as an angel full of warmth and love. Her son said that she had vowed to smile at everyone she encountered. Her students said she was passionate about teaching. And members of Fairfield's small but growing Latino community remember Graber as a humble leader with undeniable influence. Elizabeth Gortia, a longtime friend of Graber and a fellow Latina, told the Des Moines Register, "There are not many people who really give hope, who truly inspire others. Noema was that person." Like Graber, Gortia immigrated to Fairfield from Mexico. Gortia was from northern Mexico and Graber from the south. They shared their traditions. Fairfield's Latino community isn't large, but Graber made it feel whole, said Gortia. Latinos made up 2.5% of Fairfield's population back in 2000, according to the Census Bureau. In 2010, that number rose to 3.6%, and by 2020, to 5.5%. Meanwhile, since 2000, the total population of Fairfield slowly decreased to about 9,400 people. In Fairfield schools, 80 Latino children were enrolled in the 2010-2011 school year, according to data from the Iowa Department of Education. Then 10 years later, during the 2020-2021 school year, that number had grown from 90 to 122. Nearby Ottumwa, with a larger Latino population, in part due to the JBS meatpacking plant, paved the way for Fairfield to grow a Latino community of its own. Farming, manufacturing, and construction brought opportunities to Fairfield and surrounding areas, according to community members. Then the Maharishi International University opened in the city, providing more opportunities. Now, its downtown boasts at least three Latino-owned businesses, Cafe Paradiso, Hazel Moon Cafe, and Aranda's Mexican Restaurant. Just down the street from downtown, there's La Hacienda, another Mexican restaurant. Noema Graber was a young mother of two, soon to be three, in 1992 when she arrived in Fairfield, her husband's hometown, which was markedly unlike the cosmopolitan Mexican city where she grew up. At that time, few other Latinos were in town. Many in the community told the Register they could count the Latinos with two hands. Montserrat Inguez, 34, a daughter of Mexican immigrants, said, "It was painful to move to one of the whitest states in the country. I truly learned the difference between ignorance and bigotry." She says she moved to Fairfield from California in 2011. Inguez moved to Des Moines after 4 years in Fairfield and just moved back there in February. Noting a stronger Latino presence now in Fairfield, she said, "I don't feel uncomfortable like I did before." She was sitting in Hazel Moon Cafe when she told the Register, "It's really nice to see people that look like me, to see the community having a deeper appreciation of our culture." Graber's leadership grew hand in hand with Fairfield's Latino population. A faithful Catholic, Graber became active in St. Mary's Catholic Church, eventually attending Mass daily. At a vigil for Graber on Tuesday, church members spoke of her gentle soul, her giving heart and beautiful mind, and her ability to bring together people from different cultures to worship. The Reverend Nick Adams of St. Mary's Catholic Church spoke of Graber's devotion. "She always led with light," he said. Before her death, Graber would be seen at every Latino family function, birthday parties, baptisms, and other gatherings. She danced the cumbia or bachata, Gotia said, and her eyes would sparkle. Her loud laugh and smile would be contagious. Graber would welcome new community members and would rally the community to support those in need. If she noticed a student was hungry or didn't have warm clothes for winter, she'd make sure that child was fed and warm, making phone calls to community members to ask for help and connecting those in need with resources. Patricia Solis, a 44-year-old who owns Aranda's Cafe, told the Register, "We are all part of the community, but there are people who are leaders." That was Noema. "People are suffering, not just because of how she died, but who we lost, the kind of person that she was," Solis said. Gotia met Graber 10 years ago at a hospital after Gotia's 2-year-old son, Abraham, was diagnosed with a brain tumor. Doctors said he wouldn't make it. Graber was already at the hospital praying for another Latino community member who was sick, Gotia said. Then Graber heard about Gotia's son and prayed for him at the hospital too. And when doctors said Abraham would survive but would be brain dead, Graber continued to pray. Besides visiting hospitals, she would go to homes of community members who needed prayers, according to Gotia. She said, "That's just the kind of person Noema is. She'll drop everything to help others. She will always make the time." Gotia shared her comments at a vigil for Graber at Fairfield High School this past Tuesday evening. Abraham, who is now 12 and in full recovery, was with her. Gotia said, "To us, she's family. We were lucky to have Noema in our community." And in Graber's 9 years as a Fairfield High School teacher, she mentored her students and taught them the importance of peace, love, acceptance, and forgiveness. Graber made sure that parents, especially Latino parents with language barriers, were notified and involved in their children's events at school. She kept the parents up to date on their children's progress and always offered to help after school, Gotia said. 55-year-old Edith Cabrera, another longtime friend of Graber within Fairfield's Latino community, said, "All the things she still wanted to do," as her voice trailed off. A Mexican altar honoring Graeber is now on display in the center of Fairfield's Public Library, where just last week Graeber had honored the dead. There's a portrait of Graeber and some of her favorite things, an Our Lady of Guadalupe image, rose petal jam, and squirts candies. Graeber came to leadership with a humble mantra, "If I can do it, you can do it." She passed that on to many others as part of her vision for Fairfield's Latino community, to have a stronger voice, to exercise more power, and to create future leaders. She had just talked about that vision at a birthday party for Gotia's mother in October. The way others at the party nodded in agreement when Graeber spoke, Gotia said she was inspirational. People followed her because they believed in her. They still do. The community will not be the same without their leader, Gotia said, but she said, we have to keep our community. We can't lose what we have. We can't lose our faith, our hope. There is still work to do, she said. We have to be better. We have to be stronger. We have to help each other. If she were here right now, she'd say, let's keep walking. Let's help each other. Let's forgive each other.
Chauvin jurors selected saw less of infamous video. This story by Kevin McCoy, Tommy Abdullah, Eric Furkenhoff, and Dennis Wagner from USA Today. Before Derek Chauvin went on trial for killing George Floyd, legal experts predicted it would be challenging to find an impartial jury. A USA Today analysis of newly released court records shows how it was done. The 12 jurors selected had seen video of the incident fewer times than the overall jury pool, according to a review of questionnaires filled out by potential jurors. More of the selected jurors had neutral opinions of Chauvin and the other officers charged in Floyd's death, and more said they could be impartial. Trial experts say that shows the jury selection process worked, even though video of Floyd's death was watched widely and sparked worldwide protests over police brutality and racial discrimination. The goal is to end up with a higher percentage of neutral people, said Roy Futterman, a New York-based jury consultant and clinical psychologist with DOAR, a litigation consulting company. Futterman said he was not surprised by the results of USA Today's analysis. The difference between those who were selected and those who were not emerged in pretrial questionnaires designed to probe potential jurors' knowledge of the case, their views of policing, the legal system, and racial discrimination, and potential biases. Kept secret for months by the court, the questionnaires were released last week, along with the names of those considered and selected to serve. USA Today reviewed the questionnaires, focusing on answers to 6 of the 69 questions. They asked potential jurors impressions of the defendants, whether they could be impartial, how many times they saw video of the incident, and whether they were favorable or unfavorable toward Black Lives Matter and Blue Lives Matter, a pro-police slogan. The shares of seated jurors who wrote that they had a neutral impression of the defendants was greater than the jury pool, and the share of jurors with a negative impression was smaller. About 70% of the pool said they could be fair and impartial. All of the selected jurors said they could. Seating more impartial people on the jury was not enough for Chauvin to overcome the case presented by prosecutors, which relied heavily on videos showing Floyd struggling with officers and losing consciousness as he was pinned under Chauvin's knee in May 2020. The jury convicted Chauvin on charges of second-degree unintentional murder, third-degree murder, and second-degree manslaughter. He was sentenced to 22 and a half years in prison. The former officer has appealed, based in part on Hennepin County District Judge Peter Cahill's refusal to move the trial due to pretrial publicity. The jury included 6 people of color, 4 black people, and 2 mixed race. The remaining 6 were white. USA Today's findings come as juror impartiality has become an issue in 2 other high-profile trials now underway. Both have received national media coverage. In Brunswick, Georgia, 3 white men are on trial for killing Ahmaud Arbery, a black man whom, according to defense lawyers, they suspected of burglary. All but one member of the jury is white. other potential black jurors were excluded by legal challenges that defense lawyers said were made for non-racial reasons. In Kenosha, Wisconsin, Kyle Rittenhouse is being tried in the August shooting of three white men, two of whom died. The incident occurred during unrest following the shooting of Jacob Blake, who is black, by a white police officer. Rittenhouse, then 17 and armed with an AR-style rifle, testified that he was there to protect a local business. The trial's early days featured a video of the shooting, and one juror was dismissed for making a joke about Blake. Criminal courts often use questionnaires to tease out potential jurors' opinions in highly charged cases. Defense attorneys and prosecutors use their answers as a guide during jury selection. Cahill kept the Chauvin trial questionnaires under wraps, along with the identities of the 12 jurors and the rest of the jury pool, due to concerns about their safety. They were released after a coalition of news organizations, including USA Today, asked him to make them public, citing the presumption of open access to court records. USA Today repeatedly sought comment from the jurors, but they did not respond. Seven jurors recounted their deliberations in an interview with CNN days before their names were made public. They said they decided the case solely on the evidence, particularly the video of Floyd's death that has been seared into the nation's consciousness. In all, 80 out of 109 potential jurors, or 73%, wrote that they had a very or somewhat negative impression of the officers. Two others had a negative impression of Chauvin, but were neutral about the others. Eight of the 12 jurors, or 67%, had a negative impression of the defendants. Another 21 potential jurors, or 19%, had a neutral impression of the defendants, plus another who checked both negative and neutral. On the jury, it was 4, or 33%. Only three prospective jurors had a very or somewhat positive view. None was chosen. None of the jurors who decided the case wrote that they had a positive impression of the defendants. People who were selected for the jury came into the trial having seen video of Floyd's death far less than the overall jury pool. 25% of jurors had seen video at least four times compared to 44% of the jury pool, according to USA Today's review. 20% of the juror pool wrote that they had seen video once compared to 41% of the jurors who were selected. Kathleen Nowak, a registered nurse who filled out the jury questionnaire, was one of those who had seen the video once. She summarized her reaction to the video by writing a single word, traumatic. Nowak, 32, said in a phone interview, "I could not watch the whole thing, to be honest. I mean, I was sick. It just hits you in the gut. This is actual, real life," Nowak said. She wrote on her questionnaire that she had a negative impression of the defendants. Nowak was dismissed without undergoing questioning in person. Abel Saofia, 38, who is West African-born and works in information technology, was selected for the jury. He wrote that he saw video of Floyd's death just once on TV. "Although it influenced his negative view of the defendants," he wrote, "I also understand that I was not there, and I do not know what happened before the event." He wrote that he had discussed with others how it could have been me or anyone else. Tillman was the only one selected for the jury who wrote that he had not seen video of Floyd's death before the trial. Selecting jurors who had less exposure to the video may have boosted the defense, but only to a degree, said Cynthia Cohen, founder of Los Angeles-based Verdict Success. Cohen said, "You cannot erase that they had seen the video, even if they had only seen it once. Video is just very compelling. You are not there, but you are next to being there," Cohen said. Jurors ended up watching the bystander video and several others many times during the trial. Chauvin's appeal of his conviction includes arguments that Cahill erred by denying defense motions to move the trial out of Hennepin County in response to pretrial publicity and by not sequestering the jurors during trial. Cahill noted in his denial that the video was not shared solely in the Twin Cities area, but was aired across national media and went viral online. Cohen says she does not think Cahill could have mitigated potential jurors' negative impressions of Chauvin and the broad exposure to the video by moving the trial. The case was so widely known that it may have made no difference at all if it had been moved to a neighboring venue, Cohen said. People do not live under a rock.
In the Metro and Iowa section on this Friday, three stories, one across the top of the front page. Iowa alcohol-related deaths up 26%. Along the right-hand rail, farms set $83 million program record. And a second story, ex-Iowa trooper facing federal charge over 2017 traffic stop. The bottom left of the front page in the Metro and Iowa section has two photographs from yesterday's Veterans Day activities in Des Moines. The top photograph is seven men dressed warmly against the wind and the cold yesterday, one of whom is in a period military uniform. And the caption says, Mike Rowley, top left of the General Society of the War of 1812, reads a list of more than 200 names of service veterans buried in the World War I section of Glendale Cemetery in Des Moines during a Veterans Day ceremony on Thursday. And the bottom picture has Rowley standing among headstones with American flags adorning each. Rowley talks about the role that Iowans played in World War I. He stands near the grave of Tracy Carter, who he said was the first veteran buried in Glendale's World War I section. Let's take a look at the story across the top of the front page of Metro in Iowa. Iowa alcohol-related deaths up 26%. There's a photograph of a woman sitting on a couch. Renee Ellings of Norwalk tries to hold back emotions as she holds a photo of her son, Derek, who died of a drug overdose last June. This story by Tony Lays. More Iowans than ever drank themselves to death last year, a new state report says. Alcohol-related deaths in Iowa jumped 26% in 2020 to 836, according to the report from the Iowa Governor's Office of Drug Control Policy. The startling rise in such tragedies come as the COVID-19 pandemic forced many people into isolation, caused job losses, and led to increased anxiety and depression. The state also saw a record number of overdose deaths from opioids such as fentanyl and stimulants such as methamphetamine. That total climbed nearly 18% to 369 deaths. Experts say the pandemic apparently worsened addiction struggles in two ways. It made people feel more stressed and lonely, and it complicated their efforts to find support and treatment. For Iowans who were already susceptible to addiction, it was kind of like throwing gas on the fire, according to Dale Woolery, the state's drug control policy director. Iowa has been known for years as having one of the highest binge drinking rates in the country. The Federal Centers for Disease Control and Prevention ranks Iowa as fifth worst, behind only North Dakota, Wisconsin, Washington, D.C., and Montana. Woolery noted that most people who drink alcohol don't do so excessively. But the pandemic apparently complicated life for many of those who struggle. He said, it seems those who were heavy drinkers 2 or 3 years ago became heavier drinkers. Deaths counted as alcohol-related are cases where a doctor or medical examiner listed alcohol as a contributing factor. Those could include direct alcohol poisonings or cases where alcohol abuse contributed to liver failure or other fatal health issues. Iowa liquor sales broke records in 2020, according to state officials. An unusual amount of that booze was sold to people who were going to drink it at home because many bars and restaurants were closed or had limited service. Addiction treatment professionals have warned throughout the pandemic that many people were likely struggling in private with increased drinking or drug use. Christy Jenkins, behavioral health director for New Opportunities, Inc., which provides addiction treatment in Carroll, said they were stuck at home, not having access to other healthier activities. Jenkins said that when the pandemic hit, agencies like hers adapted quickly to offering treatment online. But online therapy was difficult for some clients to access, and the sessions couldn't always offer the same comfort as in-person support groups do. She said, we're human beings, meant to connect with other people. Social distancing practices, which helped slow transmission of the coronavirus, also meant many people were isolated from family, friends, and coworkers who might have urged them to seek help. Jenkins said demand for addiction treatment sank in the early months of the pandemic, but agencies are now busy with new clients. That could be good news, she said, if it means more Iowans are recognizing the signs of struggle. She said, the supports are there, and there's no shame in getting the support that you need. We're here to help. That's what we do. We are not here to judge.
Farm set $83 million program record. Federal conservation adopted amid disasters. This story by Danelle Eller. Iowa farmers turn to federal conservation programs to help cope with recent large natural disasters, helping drive spending to a record $83 million last fiscal year, the Natural Resources Conservation Service in Iowa said Wednesday. The federal programs will help Iowa farmers and landowners adopt conservation practices across 323,000 acres, including planting cover crops, terracing fields, and creating grassy waterways, according to the NRCS, which is part of the United States Department of Agriculture. The report covers spending in fiscal year 2021, which ended September 30. It does not include federal spending in the Conservation Reserve Program, called CRP, which pays farmers to remove environmentally sensitive land from agricultural production and plant species that will improve environmental health and quality. The Agriculture Department's Farm Service Agency says Iowa farmers enrolled nearly 1.7 million acres in the CRP last fiscal year. The federal government will pay $382.4 million to farmers to take those acres out of production for 10 to 15 years. Broader participation in the federal programs signals farmer adoption of conservation practices that are critical to reducing the loss of fertilizer and other nutrients that can make their way into Iowa's waterways. The previous Iowa record for spending on the NRCS program, $73.7 million, was set in 2018, the agency said. That year, the money helped establish conservation practices on 452,617 acres, it said. The response to 2019 flooding helped drive the record spending in the state, the agency said. The Iowa NRCS paid landowners about $25 million for permanent easements on flooded land, particularly along the Missouri River, which overran its banks, swamping farms, homes, and businesses, and closing major highways. Flooding in Iowa, Nebraska, Missouri, South Dakota, and other parts of the country that year caused $11.6 billion in damage, according to the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. John Hubbard, the Iowa conservationist for the NRCS, said the easement program is costly because the agency purchases the future use of the land as well as addresses damage from the storm, restoring natural vegetation. The agency said it bought permanent easements on 4,011 acres in floodplains from 24 landowners who voluntarily enrolled in the program. The government also provided nearly $2 million to help farmers who were hit hard by the August 2020 derecho. A hurricane-force storm has swept across the middle third of the state, flattening corn, soybeans, and other crops across thousands of acres, in addition to damaging structures and vehicles. The agency said it typically does not provide conservation assistance for windstorms, but wanted to help farmers with the cost to plant cover crops where corn had been flattened and replace damaged roofs. It provided assistance to 143 farmers for 34,918 acres. With the flattened corn no longer using nitrogen in the soil to grow, cover crops like cereal rye were used to hold the fertilizer in the soil, preventing it from leaching into Iowa waterways, Hubbard said. In addition to traditional conservation programs, the Iowa NRCS noted that its farmers received $1.24 million in the first year of the Iowa Soil Health Initiative, which provides assistance to farmers trying practices such as no-till or strip-till farming or diversifying their crop rotation with small grains.
Headline, ex-Iowa trooper facing federal charge over a 2017 traffic stop. This story by Ryan J. Foley of the Associated Press, Dateline, Iowa City. A former Iowa State Patrol officer with a history of excessive force allegations has been indicted on a federal charge over a 2017 traffic stop in which dash camera video captured him roughing up a motorcyclist. A federal grand jury charged Robert James Smith with violating the motorcyclist's civil rights by using unreasonable force during the September 25, 2017 stop near West Liberty, a community of about 4,000 people roughly 15 miles southeast of Iowa City. The indictment notes that the victim suffered bodily injury during the encounter, which means the charge could carry a maximum of 10 years in prison. Smith is scheduled to make his initial appearance on November 16th at the federal courthouse in Cedar Rapids. He did not immediately respond to phone messages seeking comment, and court records don't show whether he has an attorney. Dash camera video shows Smith... Hang on one second here, let me get to the right page. Smith pulling over Bryce Yakish, Y-A-K-I-S-H, for speeding. He pulled him over at a gas station off of Interstate 80. The routine stop escalated immediately when the trooper, Smith, ran from his car with his gun drawn and pointed at Yakish, who was 20 years old at the time. Smith used his left hand to strike the face shield of Yakish's helmet, knocking him backward onto his motorcycle and to the ground. Smith briefly put his knee on Yakish's neck while handcuffing him. Yakish can repeatedly be heard in the video complaining of neck pain. Smith falsely accused Yakish of trying to flee and charged him with eluding law enforcement, even though Yakish stopped immediately after Smith activated his patrol car's lights and siren. That eluding charge was dropped after a prosecutor reviewed the video and concluded that the charge was baseless. Yakish lost his license because of the arrest, his motorcycle was impounded, and he spent the night in jail. A chiropractor later treated him for neck pain. The Iowa State Patrol allowed Smith, a 30-year veteran of the force, to quietly retire in 2018 after conducting an internal investigation into the traffic stop. Smith was later hired as a police officer in the town of Durant, where he was accused of using excessive force against a woman during an arrest there. Smith's use of force during the 2017 traffic stop of the motorcyclist only became public in 2019 after the Associated Press published video of the incident obtained from Cedar County Sheriff Warren Wethington. The sheriff released the video after announcing that he would no longer book any suspects arrested by Smith into his jail. He said he could no longer vouch for the credibility of Smith, whose wife serves on the Cedar County Board of Supervisors and has been a political rival of the sheriff. Smith soon resigned from Durant's police force. Sheriff Wethington said the federal indictment comes after two prosecutors in Iowa, the Cedar County attorney and the former Muscatine County attorney, reviewed the traffic stop and determined that state charges were not warranted. The sheriff said, "I think it's really important that taxpayers know that this was overlooked by two local county attorneys." Marty Diaz, an attorney who represented Yakish in a civil lawsuit against Smith, said the case shows the importance of the public's ability to access police video. He said his client knew he had been abused, but, quote, there was no way he was going to prove that until the video's release. Diaz praised federal prosecutors for pursuing the case, saying incidents of violence by law enforcement officers had become too pervasive. He said, "It seems like every week we are seeing an event like this."
Iowa astronaut on six-month mission. Raja Shari launches to the space station. And I'm not sure if it's Raja Shari or Raja. The article is by Philip Jones. Raja Shari once dressed as an astronaut for a school project when he was growing up in Cedar Falls. The spaceship he is now wearing is no costume. Shari earned his astronaut wings when Crew 3, under his command, launched just after 8 p.m. Wednesday from Kennedy Space Center in Florida. The Crew Dragon capsule carrying Shari and three others began flying on its own 12 minutes after launch, according to USA Today, and was expected to dock at the space station late Thursday afternoon. "It was a great ride," Shari said from the spacecraft minutes after liftoff, "better than we imagined." Shari, 44, who was born in Milwaukee, grew up in Cedar Falls and graduated from Columbus Catholic High School in Waterloo. NASA named the Air Force Colonel an astronaut in 2017. He and 11 others were selected from a record pool of 18,353 applicants, more than double the previous high of 8,000. He said at the time, "We do things because they are hard, and then we crush it." Shari is the first space rookie in decades to lead a mission to orbit for NASA, according to the Associated Press, and the 10th Iowan in space. Being in the commander role, it's really more like being a coach than a dictator, Sherry said before the original launch date of October 31st. I'm super happy to have the chance to go to space. The launch was scheduled for October 31st, but was delayed due to high winds and rough seas in the Atlantic Ocean, hundreds of miles away. NASA was concerned that if the crew was forced to abort on launch, the rough seas would pose dangers for the capsule. Then, on November 3rd, another launch attempt was scrubbed because of a minor medical issue involving one of its crew members. The issue was not related to COVID-19, according to NASA's website. In total, Sherry's crew, that includes European Space Agency astronaut Matthias Mara of Germany and NASA astronauts Tom Marshburn of North Carolina and Kayla Barron of Idaho, will spend about 6 months on science experiments and station maintenance. Last year, Sherry and 15 other NASA astronauts were chosen to train for moon landings during NASA's Artemis program. The space agency hopes that humans will return to the moon by the end of 2025. Then Vice President Mike Pence said the Artemis group likely includes the next person and first woman to walk on the moon. The space agency plans to launch its 322-foot-high space launch system for the first time in February, according to the tech news website The Verge. NASA chose SpaceX in April to design and build the next lunar lander. NASA also wants to build a space station known as Lunar Gateway to make getting to the moon easier. Sherry said, to get to the moon and to stay there and to go to Mars, you need more reliable equipment and higher recovery rates than we have now. Right now, we recover between 70% and 90% of the water that is wasted on the space station that comes out of us. We need to get that closer to 98%. No Iowan has ever walked on the moon, but the first NASA astronaut with Iowa ties was the first Apollo flight. Walter Cunningham was born in Creston, but grew up in Los Angeles. Cunningham flew on Apollo 7 in October 1968, the first flight of the Apollo Command and Service Modules. All three astronauts on Apollo 7 had severe head colds, and the flight became known as the first mutiny in space when astronauts ignored a series of ground orders from controllers. Cunningham never flew in space again. Laurel Clark was born in Ames, but grew up in Racine, Wisconsin, and considered that her hometown. Clark and six other astronauts died aboard the space shuttle Columbia when it broke up while re-entering the atmosphere on February 1, 2003. Foam from the shuttle's external fuel tank hit and punctured a hole in the leading edge of Columbia's left wing on launch. During re-entry, the hole allowed super hot gases to penetrate the orbiter's heat shield. The 15-8 science mission had been successful up to that point. Peggy Whitson, originally of Beaconsfield, graduated from Mount Air High School. She flew on three International Space Station expeditions and two space shuttle missions between 2002 and 2017. Whitson, who retired from NASA in 2018, spent 665 days in space, more time than any other American or woman worldwide. James Kelly was born and raised in Burlington. Kelly piloted the space shuttle Discovery on STS-102 in 2001 and STS-114 in 2005, the first flight after the space shuttle Columbia disaster. George Pinky Nelson was born in Charles City but raised in Minnesota. Nelson flew on the space shuttles Challenger, Columbia, and Discovery in 1984, 1986, and 1988, respectively. David Hilmers was born in Clinton but raised in DeWitt. Hilmers flew on the first flight of the space shuttle Atlantis in 1985. He also made three other space flights in the 1980s and 1990s. Lauren Shriver was born in Jefferson and graduated from Peyton High School. Shriver flew on three missions, including the 1990 trip that took the Hubble telescope to space. Clayton Anderson was born in Omaha and attended Iowa State. Clayton spent 5 months on the International Space Station in 2007. He was also on a space station resupply mission in 2010. Dale Gardner was raised in Clinton. Gardner flew in 1983 on just the 8th Space Shuttle flight and just the 3rd of the Space Shuttle Challenger. Gardner also flew in 1984 on a Space Shuttle Discovery mission, which launched 2 communications satellites.
Headline, former government director says he objected to sexual research on Iowans with disabilities, a story by Tony Lays. Iowa's former human services director says he rejected a plan to run sexual arousal experiments on Iowans living in an institution for people with severe disabilities. Jerry Foxhoven, who was ousted in June 2019 by Governor Kim Reynolds, recently filed court papers in which he recounted that when he was director, he was adamant that such research not be done at the Glenwood Resource Center. The proposed research came to light during a scandal over treatment of the state's institution's residents. Jerry Ray, REA, who was then the institution superintendent, allegedly proposed the study as part of his continuing study of sexual misbehaviors among people with intellectual disabilities. The new court papers included Foxhoven's recollection of how he first heard of the proposal in a meeting with Ray and 2 other department administrators, Mickey Steer and Rick Schultz. He said, according to the documents, at the conclusion of the presentation, I questioned both the legality and the appropriateness of the proposed project at Glenwood Resource Center. Foxhoven went on to say, Jerry Ray and Rick Schultz both assured me that the project had occurred with complete transparency and approval when Jerry Ray was at the facility in Kansas. I remember specifically saying, well, as Toto told Dorothy, you're not in Kansas anymore, Foxhoven said, misattributing the Wizard of Oz quote. Foxhoven's recollection is included in court documents his lawyer filed October 26th. In a lawsuit Foxhoven is pressing in Polk County District Court against Governor Reynolds and some of her top aides. Foxhoven contends that he was wrongly fired because he objected to the way that Reynolds wanted to use federal Medicaid money to continue paying an aide who had transferred from the Iowa Department of Human Services to the governor's office. The governor has denied that and said she forced Foxhoven out partly because of his mishandling of the Glenwood Resource Center situation. Foxhoven's recollection about his opposition to the proposed sexual arousal research is included in an interrogatory transcript from a separate lawsuit that former employees of the institution filed against Foxhoven and other state officials. In that document, which was submitted as part of the October 26th filing, Foxhoven answered questions from the former employees' lawsuits. When those lawyers asked Foxhoven about the proposed sexual arousal research, he said that he believed that he blocked it. He said, after I departed from DHS and news stories were published about the project, I still believed that the proposal had never, in fact, been implemented. In fact, to this day, I am not aware that it was actually implemented. If it was implemented, it was directly contrary to my orders. The transcript was sent to Foxhoven October 22nd by an assistant attorney general defending the state against the lawsuit filed by the former Glenwood Resource Center employees. Foxhoven, who is a former Drake University law professor, contends the attorney general's office should be disqualified from defending the governor against his lawsuit while simultaneously defending Foxhoven against the lawsuit from the former Glenwood Resource Center employees. His lawyer included the state lawyer's recent email about the interrogatory as evidence that Foxhoven continues to have detailed interactions with the Attorney General's office. The Attorney General's office contends that it can ethically continue to handle both cases at once. If a Polk County judge disagrees, the state could be forced to hire private attorneys to defend the governor against Foxhoven's lawsuit. The scandal first became public in April 2019, when the Des Moines Register reported that employees blamed poor medical care for a string of deaths among Glenwood Resource Center residents. Foxhoven, who then was the department director, denied that there was a problem. The allegations of inappropriate sexual research came to light in the ensuing controversy. Jerry Ray was fired as superintendent at Glenwood in December 2019. Schultz, who was Ray's boss and had approved the research proposal, retired from the department. Investigators from the U.S. Department of Justice concluded in December 2020 that the state of Iowa likely violated the constitutional rights of the institution's residents by providing insufficient medical care and by exposing them to unethical experimentation. Kelly Garcia, Foxhoven's successor as Iowa Human Services Director, told an advisory board this week that the state and federal agencies are negotiating an agreement to settle those allegations.
Imprisoned lottery computer tech sues state. This story released by the Associated Press by David Pitt from Des Moines, Iowa. A man serving a 25-year prison sentence for conspiracy to commit theft by rigging computers to win jackpots for himself, friends, and family is suing the state of Iowa, claiming he was pressured 4 years ago to plead guilty to crimes he did not commit. Eddie Tipton filed documents starting the lawsuit from prison in Clarinda, Iowa in January 2020. He wants the court to halt all restitution he's been ordered to pay until a trial is held, during which he said he will present documents and other evidence to persuade the court to reverse his sentence. Tipton said in a statement, the sentence is cruel and unusual because it has been applied to an actually innocent person simply to see that he is charged with a crime. The state last week asked that the lawsuit be dismissed. A hearing will be held November 14 to consider setting a new trial date. Tipton worked at an Urbandale, Iowa organization that provided random number drawing computers to several lottery states. Investigators said he installed code on lottery computers that allowed him to predict the winning numbers on 3 days of the year. Tipton, at his 2017 Iowa sentencing hearing, told the judge he wrote software that included code that allowed me to understand or technically predict winning numbers, and I gave those numbers to other individuals who then won the lottery and shared the winnings with me. Tipton accepted a plea agreement and was ordered to repay $2 million in ill-gotten winnings from lotteries in Colorado, Wisconsin, Kansas, and Oklahoma. An Iowa jury also convicted him of attempting to take $16.5 million from a rigged Iowa lottery game in December 2010, but the Iowa Supreme Court in 2017 overruled the decision, saying the state took too long to prosecute him. Tipton, who has been in prison since August 2017, now claims he was placed under duress to plead guilty. He also alleges Iowa officials charged him for restitution in states for which it has no jurisdiction, and he says he cannot pay. It is not clear what happened to the money Tipton and associates got from the lottery games between 2005 and 2011. He worked with his brother Tommy Tipton and others to purchase and claim winning tickets at least 7 times, netting more than $2 million. Tipton has said he ended up with only $351,000. Assistant Attorney General William Hill asked a judge November 4th to dismiss Tipton's lawsuit, arguing in a filing that the lawsuit is barred by the statute of limitations and should be dismissed as frivolous. Hill also said by filing the lawsuit, Tipton is violating the terms of his June 29, 2017 plea agreement involving potential cases in multiple states, and that the violation provides the opportunity for all jurisdictions to reinitiate criminal charges stemming from Tipton's actions. Tipton, who has been appointed an attorney, now claims that the Iowa Supreme Court dismissal in 2017 removed the basis for the crime he ended up pleading to.
Headline, Des Moines City Council may extend new private security companies hired to replace the Connolly Group. The story by Melody Mercado. The Des Moines City Council will vote on Monday night whether to extend a temporary contract with a private security firm while it trains city employees to take the contractor's place. In October, the City Council canceled its contract with the Connolly Group after the Des Moines Register revealed what city officials called concerning emails from that company's CEO. The city then hired Permar Security Services to take over the Connolly Group's responsibilities temporarily. Des Moines City Manager Scott Sanders previously told the Register that the city planned to assemble a security team consisting of city employees who will be trained for the job with assistance from the Des Moines Police Department. According to city documents, the city needs additional time to hire more staff to fill the security roles, which is why it's proposing to spend $150,000 to extend PERMAR services through the beginning of May. If approved, the city would be able to terminate its contract with PERMAR early if staffing needs have been filled before the expiration of that contract. PERMAR currently provides security for City Hall, the Argonne Armory, and the Municipal Services Center. Well, we're so glad to have you with us on this Friday. If you're listening on your television, internet, or mobile device, and you are not a registered IRIS listener, please give us a call. We need to know who's listening and how you're listening in order to keep our services completely free. You can catch a replay of today's reading at 6 p.m. and 1 a.m. here at IRIS. Today's show, as well as many of our other newspapers and programs, are available as podcasts. Just go to our website, www.iowaradioreading.org.